Welcome to Sports and a Slice of Life. And now, here's your host, Dave Lewis.
1 year ago today, March 11th, 2020, the stock market dropped 700 points. The NBA suspended its season. We found out Tom and Rita Hanks had COVID-19. 1 year ago seemed like yesterday. Back about a year ago, Jack Cooper and I talked jazz music right around the beginning of the pandemic. Good to have Coop back. How's it going?
Good, Dave. Thanks for having me back again. It's been a long year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You are at the University of Memphis, and your official title I see is Pearl Wales Professor Rudy E. Scheidt School of Music.
Yeah. In fact, that title came this year. It was a very nice, it's a nice feather in the cap of us music professors, and I got picked as that, and it came with a little money too. So it's awesome. Not a bad thing.
Yeah. And what was your title before then?
Well, I guess I continue to be director of jazz studies there at the University of Memphis, but that's now there's a professorship. I have a professorship. So that's the way that works out.
How long have you been doing this?
I'm in my 23rd year. Yep.
At Memphis or just in the profession?
Well, in higher education, it's been, you got to add about three more years to that. So 26, 27 years I've been in higher education. But, you know, as a music professional, it's been, you know, 39 years, whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You've had a great run. What's it been like teaching during the pandemic?
I'll try and keep it clean for your listeners.
No. This is no filter. No filter.
Well, it's been kind of crappy, and it's not necessarily from my end. You know, it's from the kids' end. It's so tough on them. Oh my gosh. Wow. It's really rough. And finally, and I'll tell you one thing, like today we had a rehearsal. I think I told you we were going to do that today. And the kids are so excited to finally come in and play some music with one another. And, you know, they just didn't get to do that for a while because they couldn't come in close contact with one another. So they're pent up. You know, they want to be with one another. They want to hang out. They want to interact with one another. So that, you know, I mean, to kind of sum it up and in a nutshell, it's the kids, you know, it's not us as faculty. We'd of course love to interact with them, but boy, those kids just wanting to play music with one another. It's been tough, Dave, you know.
Everything else prior to this is all Zoom then?
Oh, yeah. It's the academic classes, like my jazz history class, which is a lecture class, and then playing examples for them and then doing stuff, you know, you can do that Zoom, though I don't like doing it in Zoom because I teach the, well, you know, I half of the people that I teach about in the last part of the class, I've played with or I know. And so I'm telling stories in class and writing on the board and remember this name. This is what he said to me or she said to me when I went out to hear him in Los Angeles or New York. And so yesterday I was talking to the kids about the great bass player Percy Heath of the Heath Brothers. And he was in the Tuskegee Airmen before he went on the road with his brothers. And I hung out till 4 a.m. having beers with Percy one night. And we just talked about all that stuff and him being with the Modern Jazz Quartet and everything. So that's what I teach. I teach off the top of my head. I use a text, but I'm teaching what I think's important to the history of the music. So I'd rather be in class doing that and having interaction with kids. But, you know, we do it Zoom, you know.
You'll have to help me when I have some of these foreign pronunciations. So the first song I'm going to play is Chateau d'If.
Yeah, Chateau d'If.
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 What does that mean?
It is chateau in the bay is what it is. It's actually a prison. It's the prison. It's like Alcatraz for French guys. It's out in the bay in Marseille. you know, in the Mediterranean, and that's what the Chateau d'If is. It's the prison.
Okay, well, we'll set the mood. Chateau d'If, yeah. Jack Cooper. I just don't think of prison when I hear that song. Do you, Coop? Like Shawshank Redemption or The Longest Yard on the soundtrack?
Well, that's our guy, the Count of Monte Cristo. He's escaping from the Chateau d'If, is what he's doing. It's him looking around corners and then diving from the top of the prison into the bay and swimming the bay and then the last part of it is him hiding in Marseille and then stealing a car and going off into the distance. That's how I envision that movement of that piece.
I have to get my French. I mean, I sound like Pepe Le Pew, and he just got canceled from Space Jam 2.
He's so done.
he's finished. I can't go there. Hey, what do you think of that? His character is said to have normalized rape culture. And now he's out. We have you on. We have you on about music. We've got you on about pop culture, the latest news, politics.
I don't know. I like Pepe Le Pew, so I don't.
Yeah, But I never thought about it when I was a kid, because he'd have the cat and we mix the beautiful music to gazelle.
I love you.
But now that I'm an adult and I can detach myself, I can see how maybe that would be inappropriate.
Yeah. It's I don't know. Yosemite Sam is pretty non-PC.
I never thought we'd go cartoons on this podcast, but
right, exactly, man.
We cover it all. Hey, I have you on mainly because you've got this brand new album, The Songs of Berlin, about to be released. And you've traveled all over the world. So what was the motivation, inspiration for this particular collection of songs?
Well, it is the Songs of Berlin, but they were hard to pick because there's actually, like New York or several other cities, there's a whole long list of stuff that relates to Berlin. And when I got hired back in, you and I talked about this a little bit before, but when I got hired back in 2015 to be the staff arranger for the Berlin Jazz Orchestra, when I got over there, my boss, who you see on the album, Mark Sicara, we decided on a project to record with, his band, the Berlin Jazz Orchestra, and we needed a theme. We needed to feature Mark, because that band very much features him as a singer, and you're probably going to play a cut or two with Mark singing here in a minute, but he's the Michael Bublé of Germany, and I write for singers real well, and so we decided to have a themed album that is all Berlin centered stuff, and we were off and running. And I, over the next about 4 months, I got everything done before I came back here to teach the next semester after being there for a year. So I guess that's the short of it. Each tune kind of has a story behind it, and how we picked each tune has a little bit of a story behind it. And Dave, I will say this, is that there were things that we didn't pick that we wanted to pick, and I worked and I worked and I worked, and I just couldn't make some things. There was a theme that was for the World Cup, a thing called Auf uns. You probably heard it if you covered in any of your sportscasts, if you covered World Cup and stuff. It was a big thing for the Germans to play, on the radio and introduce the World Cup and soccer games. But I just couldn't do anything with that tune. It's just like a loop, like a rap loop. And I just couldn't do anything with it for big band. But, some tunes were like that. And then the tunes that we picked, I think people like, and they turned out. I wrote an original. I arranged another thing that was an instrumental that our feature artist on there had written, and the rest are vocal things. Some in English and some auf Deutsch.
Well, so, what makes In Dieser Stadt so special?
Well, In Dieser Stadt, the translation is in this city. And the first thing is, it is a beloved tune that was a pop tune, and they call that category of things, that kind of pop stuff, Schlager in German. And that is very much a Schlager pop kind of tune from 1963, and Hildegard Knef, she sang it, and she actually helped write that one with Charlie Neeson. And that tune, it was written at a time during the Cold War when people were kind of down on Germany and other places, and in Germany, and Berlin was kind of a beat up, nasty place. And basically, in the first part of the tune, the lyric says, there are, papers, candy wrappers, and burnout cigarettes, and, dirty streets and everything. But, I walk these streets and they're mine, and I love, I love this city and it's my home. And the last line of it is, Hause Stadt in dieser Stadt. This is my home. So
even with all its flaws, this is my city, my house, my home.
Yes, there it is, buddy. That is it. That is the last part of it.
Dieser Staat with Jack Cooper.
Wie sieht die Stadt wohl heute aus? In dieser Stadt war ich mal zu Haus. Leere bunte Zigarettenschachteln und zerknülltes Butterbrotpapier. Auf dem Schulweg, den wir täglich machten, seh ich, als ob's heute wär vor mir. Und wir klauten auf dem Beet vom Bahnhof für die Mutter den Geburtstagsstrauß. In dieser Stadt kenn ich mich aus. In dieser Stadt war ich mal zu Haus. Zwischen zwei verdunkelten Laternen stand eine Bank, meine erste, die hieß Liz. Ich wollte gern von ihr das Küssen lernen, aber ihre Küsse waren ein Witz. Morgens grübelnd hinter blinden Scheiben wusste ich nur eines, ich will raus. In dieser Stadt kenn ich mich aus. In dieser Stadt war ich mal zu Haus. Bahnsteig an dem Schienenstrang zur großen Welt. Und ich wusste plötzlich auf dem Bahnsteig, dass mich nichts in dieser Stadt mehr hält. Heute nach allein durchweinten Nächten halte ich es vor Heimweh nicht mehr aus. In dieser Stadt kenn ich mich aus. In dieser Stadt war ich mal zu Haus. Wie sieht die Stadt wohl heute aus? In dieser Stadt war ich mal zu Haus. In dieser Stadt.
In Niederstadt, Jack Cooper. I like it.
Yeah, it works. You got a little bit of New Orleans there on the front of it, but, you know, and Mark likes it a lot. Everybody likes that. Everybody likes that cut. That's why it's the opening cut of the album.
Yeah, number one. Hey, when can that album be purchased by your fans?
It will be out. We're trying to get it out by May or June, but we're trying to write the contract right now for NRW Records in Hamburg. So the problem is, Dave, is COVID's holding it up a little bit, but we are trying hard for May or June. We had a special issue of it because there were donations that were given to get the album complete. So there's a special issue, but in the commercial market, it looks like NRW Records will be handling that just before summer. So that's what we're shooting for right now. But very proud of the album, as you might imagine. And that's actually, that was the first one. That was the first, ironically, that being first on the album, it was actually the first chart I wrote of the set of 11. So that's kind of funny how that worked out.
I'd be remiss in mentioning or not mentioning that Jigs Wiggum is the trombone soloist on that piece.
He is world famous. He is very, very well known. Yes. Been around a long time and I'm friends with the guy. That would be my other boss with that band. So both Mark and him kind of co-run that band. So, yep, he's something else.
But Jack Cooper from Memphis. And how important is it to you, Coop, to still be performing and doing it rather than just being, you know, some guy in a classroom teaching theory and helping young musicians, but you're still out there doing it?
Well, I think it's wildly important, and that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, that's what I naturally do first. But I like teaching a lot. It was good advice I was given by a guy I studied with in New York to have the day job teaching because he saw that I could teach. But he said, you know, you keep writing and do what you do. It was really nice of you to play Chateau d'If because that's the third movement of a neat piece that I got to write recently. And that shows the diversity of what I like writing. But I perform too, you know, I'm out there still performing. Nobody's performing now
right?
Because of COVID. So I haven't had a gig since I had an outdoor gig last November and I haven't really played, you know, I had a recording session. There was a recording session I did for an artist out of Los Angeles, but I was able to record here at home, you know, with mics and stuff. But I haven't, you know, we just haven't, a lot of us haven't been playing, you know, so. But that's another story. But it's important, you know, I love doing what I do. And I love writing music and I do a wide variety of it. And I like being able to do that. So
I've known you since you're about 12 years old. And all of us at that time, we were listening to Queen, disco music, you know, later on Van Halen when that got big. What got you into jazz?
Well, it's a couple of different things because we did start and there's nothing wrong with, you know, listening to that stuff. In fact, one of the tunes on here is I did a Lou Reed tune on this album and I did a Pink Floyd tune on the album, you know, that I arranged. But how I got into it, I think it was probably Dave, while you and I were in middle school together, is I was starting to play the clarinet and I heard different players playing. My mom and dad, my mom was a professional musician. Excuse me. She's a professional musician and she had a, let me get a drink of water here. Just a second.
Of course. Jack Cooper from the University of Memphis.
She and my dad had a great record collection. And I started hearing Artie Shaw on the clarinet. I heard Benny Goodman on the clarinet. By the time you and I got to high school, I heard Charlie Parker on the alto sax, and I really wanted to play alto. And so, you know, I started doing that a lot. So I guess as much as anything, hearing that, and then a friend of yours and mine, Dina Delfonte's dad, Ernie Delfonte, who's a world-class saxophone player, I started studying with him. So, that was when we were seniors in high school. And then, you know, I caught the bug and I started playing more flute and, you know, I had to play saxophone, flute and clarinet. And then I really wanted to write music and studied with some very good people in Los Angeles. And I have a knack for it. I really like writing and arranging a lot, you know, and I can do it quickly. So, I don't know if that answers every one of your inquiries, but
no, it was. Hey, I got to tell you, my son played clarinet for 1 year in the seventh grade, and we rented the instrument from a local store. And by the end of the semester, it was all dented and banged up. And I asked him, I go, "What did you do? Because I'm gonna have to pay, you know, some kind of fee to repair it." He's right. Oh, you know, we dropped it, and you know, it's just an accident. Well, anyway, his best friends also had clarinet, and theirs were all dented up too.
Right.
So his friends confessed to their parents that they were actually sword fighting with the clarinets.
I read your mind. Why would you dent up and mess up a clarinet? Well, that's what they did. Yes.
So I forget how much it cost, but I had to replace that. And
right, exactly.
So my son didn't have the same affinity or appreciation for the craft as you did.
Well, it's either Artie Shaw or Three Musketeers, right? Yeah. It's one of the two. There you go.
He wanted to be D'Artagnan more than Jack Cooper.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I my dad would have killed me because I had his clarinet. So, yeah, if I had come home with his beat-up clarinet, I don't think that would have gone over so well. So, but so be it.
I see in parentheses, cut number 5 on the album. You pronounce that for me. Goldels?
Gold Elsa, or they call it Geld Elsa, depending on what kind of German, if you want hawk German, or if you wanted to, or if you want to do the lower German, high German or low German, it'd be Gold Elsa or Geld Elsa. So that's
a combination of Strauss meets Strayhorn.
Yeah, it's the gold. It's the gold lady on top of the Ziegesauer, and the Ziegesauer is the victory column in the middle of the Tiergarten in the middle of Berlin. It's a beautiful, beautiful spot. It's my favorite spot in all of Berlin. I love going up there on my bike when it's nice and sunny and taking pictures of the Gelde Elsa. Yeah.
Had you ever thought about writing a song about Pacoima?
Yeah, it didn't go so well.
Yeah, okay, we'll stick with this one then. Gold Elsa, Jack Cooper. Thank you. Gold Elsa, Songs of Berlin with Jack Cooper.
I'm pretty proud of that one.
Yeah, you should be.
Yeah, that one, if you let indulge me for a second here.
Of course.
That one was at the end of four long days of recording. We actually, that band worked their fannies off. We recorded two albums in 4 days. And we had some difficulties. It was really bad weather that day. And that was way down in the southwest part of Berlin. One of the guys got sick. We actually had to call an ambulance because he had food poisoning. One of the bass players, we had to get another bass player in, there's some stuff we had to push to the last day to record. This was the very last thing, and we had only a limited amount of time that we could record this tune. And we got enough takes in, but, you know, I was very pessimistic if we could pull, you know, if it could get pulled together in the studio with the edits and everything, because I thought, well, the band's worn out, it won't sound good, blah, blah, blah. You know how it goes. Dave, you've worked in the studio for a long time, and you just say, well, maybe that's not going to come off. But I got to give Nico Raschke, our friend in Bonn, he pulled it together. He pulled all the takes together and was able to edit. And Simone Herrer played great trombone on that. Mark sounds great doing the vocals. So I'm very proud of that one, that we were able to resuscitate my instrumental original for the album, because Mark really liked it a lot. Nico liked it a lot and said, man, we got to put this on the album. So that's my story, and I'll stick to it. But
what's the length of time and the process of just getting one song?
You mean that kind of orchestration or?
Yeah, I know you said you were near the end and all the different takes. What about if I said, hey, do this song, what's the process in terms of time and the amount of takes and putting everything together?
Well, it's a couple of different processes in terms of, obviously when you go into the studio, you've rehearsed the band and everything's written and you've rehearsed the band. And so, I think we might've had 40 minutes left on the session time after, 4 days to get like at least three takes. You need a good solid three takes. You'd like more, you might want five takes, you know. But there's that. You get the takes, we call them beds, done. And then after that gets put into the computer and everything, you figure out if you need extra overdubs, like some lead trumpet notes that might get missed or some other things, and you overdub and you get those things. And that needed about three spots of that stuff. Then you try and get the soloist on it, and Simone took a play along track home, and he worked on it, and then he went into the studio and he recorded several solos, and we picked one, and that's the trombone solo you hear. Mark did the finishing touches actually at his house. He's got a little mini recording studio at his house in Berlin. And he did the vocals, the male vocal that you hear on that. And then the person who is doing the engineering and the mixing of the album has to spend some time on it and put things together and balance things out and make things sound really pretty. And that on a tune like that, it takes him a half a day. You know, it takes Nico a good half a day. He spends a lot of time on this, and he did a wonderful job on this whole album. So we got to give him a lot of credit. So I'm not sure if that there, it's different processes, Dave, by the time you get to the end, you know? So that's that, but that didn't, involve writing it. I don't know. Sometimes I'm very inspired and I can get something done in a couple of days. And then sometimes writing the thing, I don't know. Sometimes I have a little bit of a problem and it might take a week to get something done, but usually I write faster than that. I usually don't have problems, but it's fairly involved,
Like an athlete, a great shooter, they get in the zone where it just flows. Everything's easy. And then there's days where just nothing goes in the basket. Do you have the same kind of experience as a musician where, hey, there's just days where the songs just flow off the, your pen, and it just, it's easy to record in the studio and everything just comes together pretty easily, when there's just some days where, man, everything sucks?
Well, yeah, and there's kind of a process that I talk to my kids about that I truly believe in, and you have to allow the process to happen, is that once you kind of get, you know, just like an athlete, and I always use the athletic analogies. You and I played lots of sports, so, you know, I mean, they're good analogies to use. I think that there's the practice makes perfect thing happens, and you write. You have an idea of what you want to write. And in this case, I knew I wanted to write a Viennese waltz, you know, but for big band, you know. And I love Billy Strayhorn. I love Duke Ellington, you know, they're writing together. And so, and I use a lot of tricks from Strayhorn. So I've learned Strayhorn's tricks, you know, I've got those tricks, you know, like a guy doing layups or shooting a three-pointer or shooting a three-pointer from the corner. They practice those things and they've got all those tricks that they can put it in the basket. So I've got a lot of compositional tricks. And so you work on that. And sometimes you have a mental block or you're not getting to where you want to be. And I put it down for a little bit, Dave. I'll let it gestate in my subconscious and I just go to sleep. And then I usually wake up in the morning or the next morning and it comes to me. So I kind of allow the computer to work on it in the subconscious, you know, and then I come back to it and it's like, oh, that's what I really want. And then it starts to write itself after that. So there's a process that I use, but I've got all my tricks, you know, and I use all my tricks. And then you allow your creative mind, your inner mind, your, you know, subconscious to work on it.
You sound like that athletic, crafty veteran. I've got all my tricks.
Well, you do. Yeah. I mean, you do as a composer. John Williams is a big hero of me and all the people I know. Because, I mean, my gosh, Dave, he goes back to, you know, writing Lost in Space and Twilight Zone and all those things in the 1960s. That guy never come. My gosh. I mean, he's amazing, the stuff he has come up with. And he's known for Star Wars, but he goes way back before that. But that guy knows tricks like you wouldn't believe, you know. But he went to Juilliard School of Music in New York, and he's a great pianist, and he just knows how to do all this stuff. But that's you kind of learn that stuff to be able to write quickly. You know, I don't want it to sound like you know a guy putting a carburetor in a car, but you got to know how to do that. You got to know what carburetor it is. You got to know what engine that you're putting the carburetor on, and you got to be able to do it quickly. And you've got to have done enough carburetors that you can do it quickly and get the car back out of the garage and back on the road. And it, you know, it's a little bit that way sometimes.
Now, song number 10 is a song that most folks do know. And are you challenged to add your own little wrinkle to it while maintaining the purity of the original of Mack the Knife? Or do you want to make it sound the same? You know, what's the goal in something like that?
That's a really good question. In this case, I was, as with in most everything on here, I was trying to find a little bit of something that would be mine or make it mine. In this case, first of all, is I felt, well, of course, for a German audience, it needed to be in the original German. And so it needed to be very lyrical that way. But I wanted something that was going to hit people in the face real hard. Because the other versions that I had heard that are German versions were like kind of oompa, 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 like old German band oompa from when it was written, 1928. And it's supposed to be this kind of satirical thing about, you know, Mack the Knife going around and killing people. You know the play, you know, that's what it's about. It's a very satirical look on society and, you know, everybody's downtrodden and there's this guy going around being basically a smartass and he's just knifing people. You know, he's Jack the Ripper of Berlin is Mack the Knife, Mackie Messer, you know? So I wanted a different take that was, I wanted it up tempo. I didn't want the oompa thing. I tried to work it out where the lyric was still sung in the meter, in the musical meter that you normally hear it, but what's going on under it is double time, real fast jazz. So I wanted, you know, that was my take on it. And nobody had done it that way before. I listened to many, many, from Bobby Darin to Ella Fitzgerald to the original to, I God knows, I listened to Michael Bublé doing it. Nobody had done it the way I did it. So that's what I came up with.
The suspense is killing me. Without further ado, Mackie Messer, Jack Cooper, Songs of Berlin.
Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und McKeith, der hat so ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht. An einem schönen blauen Sonntag liegt ein toter Mann am Strand und ein Mensch geht um die Ecke, den man Mackie Messer nennt. Verschwunden und so mancher sehr reiche Mann und sein Geld hat Mackie Messer, dem man nichts beweisen kann.
Mackie Messer, Jack Cooper, Songs of Berlin. Your take is dope. Is that inappropriate to say?
Oh, absolutely. Es wunderbar. Fantastische.
I just don't know if I think, you know, this beautiful jazz music and I call it dope. Like I just crossed a line I shouldn't cross.
No, not at all. No, it's fine. There's lots of things you could say. And that I'll take that as certainly a compliment. Yeah.
You know what I wanted to ask you, Jack, is that I've seen you on video as an orchestra leader, you know, swinging your baton around and directing different, you know, sections. What makes someone really good at that and what makes someone suck at it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess partly physically feeling the music. You got to know where you are in the music. And I think there are good conductors who can, I guess it's like a dancer in a way. I guess you, have to be able to physically portray the music, Dave. I guess that's the best way I can say it, because there are conductors and certainly conductors I've been with. I can tell you kind of a not nice, but a story that tells you about it very much. I was in a Broadway pit one time. It was on a touring orchestra, and I forgot what the thing was. It was may have been Chorus Line or something, Dave. And when you're in the pit and you have the conductor and they're giving you cues and you're kind of way away from them, you know, you're in a section that's way away, and the pit orchestra is always in a very funky position because they're under the stage and they're stretched out to the left and right. They're not deep. So I'm away from this conductor. Oh my gosh. This conductor was starting to have cerebral palsy, and they were trying to keep the conductor on so they could get their union pension. Well, the conductor is making these rather strange movements, and people are coming in the wrong place because we're going by the cue of the conductor, and the conductor keeps on talking to us and screaming at us over the mics, and we're like, well, what can we do? And we talk to the contractor, and it's like, well, the movements are not, you know, they're wrong, in the wrong place. The movements that conductor's giving are wrong cues because they, you know, they're because of the physical problems that this person. So that's kind of weird and graphic, but it shows you how important it is for the conductor at times to give, you know, the proper cues and to be able to do that physically and portray the music physically. So I to make a long story longer, that, you know, that's that kind of illustrates that perfectly. You know, the players have to be able to see the music through you, you know, be able to come in, you know, at times if there are important cues like that, especially for a show of that kind. So that, I hope that kind of illustrates that for you, but that's how important that is.
It does. I was thinking, though, of watching, say, like Bruno Mars and their band, or maybe a rock band. They're not having a conductor. They're right. They're using it by feel. They hear the song, they play it, right?
Yeah.
Or is there somebody orchestrating them?
Yeah, that stuff has such a heavy beat to it and such a heavy drum beat that it doesn't really take someone who's a conductor to be able to give cues. You know, I would never conduct a group like that. I just don't do that kind of conducting for that group. And in fact, when something has such a heavy beat that you get out of the way as a conductor when you conduct, and you kind of look like a fool if you're trying to conduct something like that, that has so much drums and so much bass and so much everything. Like you wouldn't conduct a Stevie Wonder tune, really, you know? I mean, or a Bruno Mars tune, really, you know? That's just not something you would do. You don't have to, and you look kind of dumb doing it. But Beethoven's Fifth, you conduct, you know? So it depends.
Those guys couldn't do it by feel?
You mean an orchestra, a symphony orchestra?
Yeah,
they could. Yeah, they could. But I think that there are different, I will tell you this, I think there are different interpretations of certain music. Like an example is my wife, Oksana. She can always listen to recordings of Russian orchestras and really make a differentiation between a Russian orchestra playing Russian music or a German orchestra playing Russian music or an American orchestra playing Russian music. And it has to do with kind of the relationship between the conductor and the players and them having a good feel of the music together. Like when you listen to Tchaikovsky, any Tchaikovsky stuff, played by a Russian orchestra, it's a huge difference. It's a huge difference. It's partly their music, and they've grown up with it and everything. And you listen to a Russian or a German orchestra doing it, and they usually do it too fast. They usually do it too marchy sounding, you know, like a German march. It doesn't have the passion that a Russian orchestra would have, for instance. So there's a difference. There's a difference. They could play it by themselves, but it's not going to have the feel and the final touch to it that, you know, you might get from a really good conductor with a really good orchestra. So, but they know the music, they could do it, you know?
Yeah. Your music's such a great escape for folks doing some other things, their 9-to-5 job, their regular grind. What about you? Because this is what you do for a living. What kind of things do you like to do to get away and maybe detach from music for a while? Clear your head.
Well, I like traveling with my wife. You know, you see that I travel a lot, and that helps me a lot. Like over Christmas, we were in the Canary Islands. We love going down there, and we were on we were on Lanzarote, on the northern island, and that's a thing we like doing a lot. We're going to be going to Portugal coming up in July. And that will be really nice. So we like doing that. We like hiking a lot. I like doing that. And we like hiking together a whole lot these days. You know, and I go work out and stuff, and that helps me a lot to clear my head. I like riding my bike, especially in Berlin, a lot. So I'm a bike rider and a hiker, I guess, these days.
What kind of hiking is there in Memphis?
Oh, there's not much. You have to go... you have to go out to a place called Shelby Farms, way out to the east. I used to live out there, but you have to go out there, and there's more trails and stuff. It's not like hiking, you know, in the mountains. You know, it's not that. We don't have any real mountains around here, but there's hiking, and, you know, there's forest area out east. And there's, you know, some nice forest area down in Mississippi, but it's not hills. Not like, you know, not like the Austrian Alps. Like, we were in the Austrian Alps this past summer, and that's real hiking, buddy. That's, oh boy. I lost 10 pounds over the summer hiking.
It's a fun way to do it, though.
Oh, yeah, it's great. That was, gosh, that was just gorgeous, being in the Austrian Alps. It was really, really nice. But again, I love traveling. And my wife really, she says, in July, we're going to blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, I guess we're going to wherever, you know? So she has it all pre-planned, and we go, and I never object. So
you mean you're in a relationship where the wife calls the shots?
Yeah, I happen to.
Oh, imagine that.
Yeah. So, but she's a good one to call the shots. She's super organized. She's a very good lady, and she's super smart. Great musician, and she speaks four languages fluently. You know,
I mentioned Oksana a couple times. Now, where did you meet her?
I met her here in Memphis a few years back, a while ago. She had finished up a doctorate at the University of Memphis. We kind of had met one another. And then didn't see one another for about 3 years. And then I saw her again, and we went out. By that time, I'd been single for a good 5 years or something like that. And we hit it off, and the rest is history. So we've been married for 11 years now. So, yeah.
There's been many relationships on my podcast I've strengthened by the guest talking about their significant other in such glowing terms that their bond becomes stronger than ever before.
Ah, okay. I guess I have to play this back for my my lovely wife.
Hey, I get you on to, you know, promote the songs of Berlin, but all of your stuff I love. So I have a couple other songs. I want to play one of them. And obviously my foreign language isn't as great as yours to pronounce. Notte de Venezia?
Notte a Venezia.
Notte a Venezia.
Yeah, Notte a Venezia.
Where did the song come from?
It is a night in Venice, and it was inspired, and I really think it does a good job of one. The last night, we spent 2 days in Venice, and the last night we were there, we took a boat ride through the canals of Venice, and this is a vision of people on their back porches of their houses, having wine and eating and So you might see a party here and a couple there making out and, you know, and little kids playing on behind another house and then a storefront. And but it's going, this is a vision at night of the in the canals of Venice around 10 p.m. So that's what it is.
All right. Check it out. Jack Cooper. Jack Cooper. Hey, was that what's the instrument I'm thinking of? Xylophone?
Vibraphone.
Vibraphone.
You're close. The xylophone would be an octave higher than what than a vibraphone. But you're close.
Does it look different?
Yeah, it's the vibraphone or the xylophone looks like a mini vibraphone. Yeah. One is okay. Half the size of the other.
All right.
Yeah, they look alike, but one is literally half the size. And then the marimba from the other one, from the big instrument from the Chateau d'If, that looks like a giant vibraphone. That's double the size of the vibraphone. So,
okay,
yeah,
educational experience for the host, along with playing some great music. Jack Cooper from the University of Memphis. With us today, and we've had some discussions off air and on social media, and you've got some pretty strong opinions on the world and politics. Do you ever go off on any of this stuff with your students, or do you keep that in a separate compartment of life?
Well, we're supposed to keep it in a separate compartment, and for the most part, I do, because I don't think it's fair to impose upon kids necessarily in that. So just as a small tangent, anybody who gets into this thing about how we brainwash kids at college, Dave, we don't have time for that. We have to teach them music and teach them how to be professional. So this idea that they come to the college and become, you know, liberal, whatever, and, you know, are brainwashed, that there's lots of studies that say, no, that just doesn't happen. That's the first thing. But there are times, and I will tell you, try and make it quick, but when a certain person was voted into office in 2016, and the next day after the election, one of my Black students was approached by a rather bigoted person telling them, see, I told you so, and tried to pick a fight with my Black student. That was very upsetting for me. I heard that story that afternoon, and I had a pretty close moment with my student, reassuring him this is not the way people are, you know. So, yeah, I have some strong opinions. 60% of my students are Black. So, you know, and I'm a very fair guy. And I think all my students have to be supported, you know. So, yeah, I got some strong opinions about it. But that happened. And that's when I step in and I have to talk to my students. And not from a political point of view, but from a very human point of view, Dave. So That was a tough day.
Well, we'll go off on the big lie on a different show then.
Well, yeah, I know. But, you know, so sometimes being a human is unavoidable. You know, my kids always look at me at this kind of professor, this steely professor guy who makes them work their butts off. But, it's not bad to be human. You know, they get my human side, and they appreciate that, you know, and I support them very much. So, you know, that's all about. It's not about the politics being on a university campus. It's about being it's about trying to help kids be good people, good citizens. You know, I always say that, you know, but that's important to me. Just make the kids be good people.
That really should be the role of any educator or coach, right? It's more than just about teaching some notes and chords and whatever, but making them well-rounded and make the world a better place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm most proud of my kids that have, I'm proud of the ones that become professional musicians and can do the craft, can really do that. But the ones that do that and then go beyond that and become educators themselves, that's hard to do. To go into teaching is not easy, and it's not for the faint of heart at all. You just can't go into teaching. That's always been a gripe of mine, is when we send kids through a music education degree, and all of a sudden at 22 years old, they're supposed to be teaching high school kids that they're barely 4 years older than, you know? That doesn't make any sense at all, you know, and that's why I came to teaching later, because it was given, you know, you met my mom, you know, that, I mean, she came to teaching when she was 39, 40 years old. And I came to teaching finally when I was 35. And I think you have to have some life experience. I think that's really important. And I try and teach that even to my young kids that are about to go out and teach at 20. To 23, and it's like, you know, so yeah, you got to make good people, and you got to have some experience as a person to make a good person. So, you know,
I didn't want the music to end. So during that last song, I downloaded another one of yours that I'll play on the closing credits. So this is where I wrap up the show. Normally I have some podcast closing music, but I'll end with a Cooper song. So this podcast executive producer is Hunter Lewis. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, and iHeartRadio. Your positive comments, your 5-star reviews are huge. Like, all of Jack's friends are going to give us one for this. It helps us big time as we move ahead. Anyway, you were fantastic, Coop.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Dave. It's great talking to you, as always.
Tell me about Leon de Palamidi.
Leon de Palamede. It's the Lion of Palamede. And the Lion of Palamede sits over the entrance of the Fortress of Palamede. And it is it's in Nafplio, Greece. And it was the fortress of the Venetians. The Venetians had taken over that part of Greece. They built the fortress way up on this hill that overlooks the Mediterranean, looking out to Crete. If you can see, Crete way, way off in the distance. And it got taken over by the Ottoman Empire. Then the Greeks took it back. Then the Venetians took it back. Then finally the Greeks took it back. So it has been battle hardened and it's a beautiful fortress, but this, I feel like this piece kind of has a lot of energy to it, and the energy of what the Lion of Palamede has seen.
You know, I was kidding you about, you know, writing a song about Pacoima, and I know that's dumb, but are there any cities in America or just some areas that you think would be appropriate to have some great composition like you do with these great locations in Europe?
Well, yeah, there are a number of places
that you haven't done yet.
That I haven't done yet? I don't know. Maybe Austin, Texas. I lived there for 3 years, and I don't know if Dave, I don't know if there's an Austin tune, and it's a lovely place. I like the city a whole lot. I think it's a jewel, the jewel of Texas, you know, in many ways, you know. But I don't think there's an Austin one. So maybe we ought to, you ought to write some lyrics, man. You'll write the text and I'll write the music.
I don't know how I can make a jazz song about having a mayor say, hey, wear a mask, and the governor says, don't do it.
there you go. I think that they're already, I will tell you this. I have already heard comedic tunes about mask wearing. They're out there, but someone's got to do one about Austin and the wonderful governor versus the mayor. And you know, maybe it'll be a guitar battle or something, you know, or a drum battle.
It has absolutely nothing to do with Leon de Palamede, but we've gotten off topic many times, and I like it.
Yeah.
One more Cooper song on the way out. Hey, thanks, man. I love the visit.
Thanks, Dave.